听力课堂，听 class.com。
Lesson 5. Hegemony. Entwine. Pharmaceutical. Deliberation. Attribute. Preeminent. Impact. Hazel. Sallow. Murmur. Exultant. Strand. Wisp. Fleece. Trot. Bedding. Ecstasy. Thrush. Nestle. Caress. Lament. Fret. Stoop. Anguish. Lamentation. Wail. Squire. Waistcoat. Egotism. Brevity. Enviable. Gastric. Torrid. Negate. Deplete. Nurture. Outgrow. Affiliate. Appraise. Archive. Benign. Bilateral. Browser. Thatch. Mirth. Clutter. Clatter. Fidelity. Chastity. Miscellaneous. Corroborate. Dauntless. Invigorate. Passage 1. It is nothing new that English use is on the rise around the world, especially in business circles. This also happens in France, the headquarters of the global battle against American cultural hegemony. If French guys are giving in to English, something really big must be going on, and something big is going on. Partly it's that American hegemony. Didier Benchimol, CEO of a French e-commerce software company, feels compelled to speak English perfectly because the internet software business is dominated by Americans. He and other French businessmen also have to speak English because they want to get their message out to American investors, possessors of the world's deepest pockets. The triumphs of English in France and elsewhere in Europe, however, may rest on something more enduring. As they become intertwined with each other politically and economically, Europeans need a way to talk to one another and to the rest of the world, and for a number of reasons, they've decided upon English as their common tongue. So when German chemical and pharmaceutical company Hoechst merged with French competitor Rhône-Poulenc last year, the companies chose the vaguely Latinate Aventis as the new company name and settled on English as the company's common language. When monetary policymakers from around Europe began meeting at the European Central Bank in Frankfurt last year to set interest rates for the new Euroland, they held their deliberations in English. Even the European Commission, with 11 official languages and a traditionally French-speaking bureaucracy, effectively switched over to English as its working language last year. How did this happen? One school attributes English's great success to the sheer weight of its merit. It's a Germanic language, brought to Britain around the 5th century A.D. During the first four centuries of English-speaking rule that followed the Norman conquest of 1066, the language morphed into something else entirely. French words were added wholesale, and most of the complications of Germanic grammar were shed, while few of the complications of French were added. The result is a language with a huge vocabulary and a simple grammar that can express most things more efficiently than either of its parents. What's more, English has remained ungoverned and open to change. foreign words, coinages, and grammatical shifts in a way that French, ruled by the purist Academia Francaise, has not. So it's a swell language, especially for business, but the rise of English over the past few centuries clearly owes at least as much to history and economics as to the language's ability to economically express the concept win-win. What happened is that the competition, first Latin, then French, then, briefly, German, faded with the waning political, economic, and military fortunes of, respectively, the Catholic Church, France, and Germany. All along, English was increasing in importance. Britain was the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution, and London, the world's most important financial center, which made English a key language for business. England's colonies around the world also made it the language with the most global reach. And as that former colony, the U.S., rose to status as the world's preeminent political, economic, military, and cultural power, English became the obvious second language to learn. In the 1990s, more and more Europeans found themselves forced to use English. The last generation of business and government leaders who hadn't studied English in school was leaving the stage. The European community was adding new members and evolving from a paper-shuffling club into a serious regional government that would need a common single language, if it were to get anything done. Meanwhile, economic barriers between European nations have been disappearing, meaning that more and more companies are beginning to look at the whole continent as their domestic market. And then the internet came along. The net had two big impacts. One was that it was an exciting, potentially lucrative new industry that had its roots in the U.S., so if you wanted to get in on it, you had to speak some English. The other was that by surfing the web, Europeans who had previously encountered English only in school and pop songs were now coming into contact with it daily. None of this means English has taken over European life. According to the European Union, 47% of Western Europeans, including the British and Irish, speak English well enough to carry on a conversation. That's a lot more than those who can speak German, 32%, or French, 28%, but it still means more Europeans don't speak the language. If you want to sell shampoo or cell phones, you have to do it in French or German or Spanish or Greek. Even U.S. and British media companies that stand to benefit most from the spread of English have been hedging their bets. CNN broadcasts in Spanish. The Financial Times has recently launched a daily German language edition. But just look at who speaks English. 77% of Western European college students, 69% of managers, and 65% of those aged 15 to 24. In the secondary schools of the European Union's non-English-speaking countries, 91% of students study English, all of which means that the transition to English as the language of European business hasn't been all that traumatic, and it's only going to get easier in the future. Passage 2. They decided to bury him in our churchyard at Greymead, under the beeches. The widow would have it so, and nothing might be denied her in that state. It was a magnificent morning in early spring when I watched among the trees to see the procession coming down the hillside. The upper air was woven with the music of the larks, and my whole world thrilled with the conception of summer. The young pale windflowers had arisen by the wood gale, and under the hazels, when perchance the hot sun pushed this way, new little suns dawned and blazed with the real light. There was a certain thrill and quickening everywhere, as a woman must feel when she is conceived. A sallow tree in a favored spot looked upon a pale gold cloud of summer dawn. Nearer, it had poised a golden fairy bushy on every twig, and was voiced with a hum of trees. Like any sacred golden bush, uttering its gladness in the thrilling murmur of bees and in warm scent, birds called and flashed on every hand. They made off exultant with streaming sands of grass or wisps of fleece, plunging into the dark spaces of the wood and out again into the blue. A lad moved across the field from the farm below with a dog trotting behind him. A dog, no. A fussy, black-legged lamb, trotting along on its toes with its tail swinging behind. They were going to the mothers on the common, who moved like a little gray cloud across the dark gorse. I cannot help forgetting and sharing the Sphinx's triumph when he flashed upon the fleece from a bramble bush. It will cover the bedded moss. It will weave among the soft red cowhair beautifully. It is a prize. It is an ecstasy to have captured it at the right moment, and the nest is nearly ready. Ah, but the thrush is scornful. Ringing out his voice from the hedge, he sets his breast against the mud, models it for the warm turquoise eggs, blue, blue, bluest of eggs, which cluster so close and round against the breast, which round up beneath the breast, nestling content. You should see the bright ecstasy in the eyes of a nesting thrush. because of the rounded caress of the eggs against her breasts. Till heralds come, till heralds wave like shadows in the air, crying, lamenting, fretting forever, rising and falling and circling round and round, the slow waving pewits cry and complain, and lift their broad wings in sorrow. They stoop in anguish and protest. They swing it up again, offering a glistening white breast to the sunlight, to deny in it black shadow, and then a glisten of green, and all the time crying and crying in despair. The pheasants are frightened into cover. They run and dart through the hedge. The old cock must fly in his haste, spread himself upon his streaming plumes, and sail into the wood's security. There is a cry in answer to the pewits, echoing louder and louder, stronger the lamentations of the lapwings, a wail which hushes the birds. The men came over the brow of the hill, slowly, with the old squire walking tail and straight in front. Six bowed men bearing the coffin on another shoulder, treading heavily and cautiously. Under the great weight of the glistening white coffin, six men follow behind, ill at ease, waiting for their turn for the burden. You can see the red handkerchief knotted around their throats, and their shirt fronts blue and white between the open waistcoats. The coffin is of new unpolished wood, glimming and glistening in the sunlight. The men who carry it remember all their lives after the smell of new warm wood.